Could a drone strike be considered a war crime? Today, Tuesday, October 22nd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. America's use of drones comes under fire from rights groups. Amnesty International says civilian deaths from U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan may constitute war crimes. But this Pakistani says the attacks are effective weapons in the fight against terrorism. Besides, he says Pakistan's military has done far worse.
Hundreds of villages have been wiped out from the face of Earth. And now when I see my village, it doesn't exist anymore on the Google Earth.
Also later on the program, a former aid worker on the unglamorous side of relief work.
It's really difficult to try to distill some of these experiences into party-appropriate stories.
Plus, what makes sriracha the hottest hot sauce in America?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS, with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates premieres October 28th at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When U.S. officials discuss drone strikes, if they discuss them at all, they emphasize the effectiveness of using unmanned aerial vehicles to hunt and kill terrorism suspects in faraway places. Well, a new report by Amnesty International paints a more disturbing picture. The rights group examined 9 drone attacks that took place in the North Waziristan region of Pakistan since January last year. The attacks resulted in several civilian deaths, people who Amnesty says were not involved in fighting and posed no threat. And it says those deaths may constitute war crimes. Noreen Shah is an advocacy advisor with Amnesty International in Washington. What evidence did you find to support the position that there were unlawful killings in Pakistan from drone strikes?
You know, Pakistan is a place that is full of speculation and a lot of rumors about what's happening in drone strikes. And this is a heavily politicized issue. So Amnesty International took great care in assembling separate teams to go in and interview people in the very dangerous parts of North Waziristan where these strikes were occurring. What we found was disturbing. A 68-year-old grandmother was killed while gathering vegetables in a large vacant field. We don't have any indication that she was involved in posing an imminent threat to the United States or was involved in a militant group. In another strike that we documented, 18 laborers were killed. One of them was a 14-year-old boy. They were gathered for a meal at the end of the day. An initial strike occurred, a second one, and many people were killed.
I mean, U.S. officials claim that interviews with locals don't provide accurate number of civilian casualties or information because relatives or acquaintances of the dead refuse to admit that the victims were involved in militant activities. It's like a taint.
Well, you know, the U.S. government wouldn't provide us any information about these cases, and we did write letters requesting information. The Pakistani government officials that we met with made some allegations about involvement, but when we investigated those, and we investigated them very carefully, we found that it would be hard to imagine that a 68-year-old grandmother was involved with a militant group. There was no one else in the area where she was struck, and she was in a large vacant field. That raises questions about what the U.S. government is doing.
We're about to hear, Noreen, that Pakistan's own military leaves many dead civilians in its wake when they attack extremists, more so than U.S. drones. So how confident are you that your data lines up with the reality on the ground?
The Pakistani military has committed serious abuses, including indiscriminate killings in these same areas. An additional problem is that militant groups pose a huge threat to local civilian populations and have committed human rights abuses. We're calling on the Pakistani government to hold these groups accountable for the abuses that they've perpetrated and hold their own members of the military accountable as well.
So, Noreen, one of the most provocative parts of the report is this idea that U.S. drone strikes may constitute war crimes. Can you take that apart for us? What part of the drone operation is a war crime?
We documented a disturbing trend of what we call rescuer attacks. These are attacks where the initial strike occurs, killing some individuals and wounding others. Before the second strike, groups of civilians will rush in to protect the injured, provide them aid. Now, we're not sure that all of those individuals are civilians, but certainly they're rushing in to provide medical assistance. Then 10 minutes after the initial strike, a second strike occurs. That, in the cases that we have documented, resulted in killings of civilians and killing of wounded individuals, which could amount to a war crime if done intentionally.
What about the wisdom among Washington policymakers that drones are a necessity? They prevent troop casualties, excessive troop casualties. You can launch an operation with relative ease quickly and cheaply. What's the alternative?
Our policy isn't in opposition to drone technology per se. Drone technology is rapidly proliferating. Other governments around the world are going to be acquiring it. The question is, what kind of message is the U.S. government sending about its own use of drones? Is it sending the message that this technology should be used to evade accountability, to conduct killing secretly, or does the U.S. government want to send a message that this drone technology can be used in a way that complies with international law?
Noreen Shah is an advocacy advisor with Amnesty International in Washington. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Government officials in Pakistan have denounced American drone attacks as a violation of their sovereignty. The strikes are also intensely unpopular with the general public, but that's not the case with all Pakistanis.
I have been witness to the aftermath of a couple of drone attacks that took place in my village. And we know that in those places, there were these international terrorists from all around the world living there, involved in making IEDs that were being sent to Afghanistan. So my personal knowledge, as far as that goes, we know that the drone attacks have been taking out dangerous terrorists.
That's Mohammed Zubair. He's a PhD law student at Indiana University, and he's from the volatile tribal area of South Waziristan, along the border with Afghanistan. Zubair says people back home have strong feelings about the attacks.
There's a marked difference between the opinion of the people who have been on the ground in the areas where these drone attacks have been taking place and those who are living in the comfort zones of the big cities of Islamabad, Lahore, and Karachi. Those people who have been on the ground, in fact, they have been always very happy with these drones, precisely for the reason that they have been taking out very dangerous terrorists who have the blood of hundreds and thousands of people on their hands. And then the people from the same area also make a comparison between what the Pakistan Army and the Air Force has been doing in the last so many years and what drones have been doing. We see that the army operations have resulted into indiscriminate killing. They have resulted into hundreds of villages having been wiped out from the face of Earth. Now when I see my village, it doesn't exist anymore on the Google Earth.
You said that the people in South Waziristan are happy with these drones. I'm just wondering, though, even though there have been scores of dead civilians who we hear have nothing to do with international terrorism, they're still happy with the drone strikes?
I would always question this identification of a certain civilian having been killed in those attacks. The reason being very simple. It's a standard operating procedure of these terrorists that whenever any drone attack takes place, the terrorists and these militants come and they surround that area. They do not even allow the local people for help purposes so that they could come and dig out, you know, the bodies. And the only reason is that they don't want the identity of those targeted in these attacks. They don't want the identity to be known to the public. So in the presence of this iron curtain wrapped around these tribal areas, I do not exclude the possibility of certain civilians having been killed. But then at the end of the day, it is a war. Mm. In war, there are collateral damages, no doubt.
The other thing that intrigued me, something you said a moment ago, that the Pakistani army themselves, they're going into Waziristan and they're carrying out raids. And as you said, indiscriminately, they're killing civilians. So I don't want to compare who's more guilty, but from your own research, I mean, how does a U.S. drone strike compare with the attack staged by Pakistan's own army?
This is exactly the point of frustration that people remain silent over what the Pakistan Air Force has been doing. There was this lady, old lady, in 2011 when I was involved in the relief activities when these people came from Waziristan. And this old lady was telling me the difference between the two. She said that when Bambangana, they call it in the local language, when drone attacks comes, everybody continues their life as usual because they go after the sinner, as she called them. And when the Pakistan Army plane comes, I mean, everybody gets to the shelter because there is no discrimination amongst the civilians. And then people are very intelligent. They make this analysis. They say that, well, this much bombing by the Pakistan army, why not a single terrorist has been eliminated or taken out? Then on the other hand, the drone attacks have resulted into taking out people like Baitullah Masood, whose atrocities the local people have been suffering for years and years. So people are very happy for whoever has taken out, for example, Baitullah Masood and Qadi Hussein, who was the master of suicide bombers.
Mohammed, it sounds like what you're saying is that you disagree with the Amnesty International charge that the U.S. drone strikes may classify as a war crime, and it's Pakistan that's committed the war crime. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. That is my point that I want to make. I mean, the Waziristanis, myself or other Waziristanis, would be very happy to see their own government, their own state coming in, eliminating these terrorists, cleaning those areas, launching development, building schools, bringing in jobs. But the problem is, it's the question of willingness. Pakistan does not want to clean these areas. It still has an eye on using these terrorist group as a tool of foreign policy in Afghanistan and against India post-2014.
Mohammed Zubair is a law student at Indiana University. He's from South Waziristan, a part of Pakistan where U.S. drone strikes have been reported. Now, not all drones are used for anti-terrorism or military purposes, but those who work with drones in other contexts could be excused for feeling unfairly tarnished by association. Patrick Egan is a self-described drone advocate who's been working in the industry for a decade. He says there's no question the technology is also being used for good.
Feeding a hungry world, private public asset management, erosion studies, anti-poaching efforts, anti-deforestation, you know, and the list goes on and on and on. I kind of call it like a lotus flower technology, which just keeps giving.
I think people in Yemen and Pakistan would say drones are probably fairly disruptive as a technology. But of course, it's not only military uses. When you tell people you're a drone advocate, what kind of reaction do you typically get?
It depends on who I'm talking to. You can go and you can talk to people. I've been called drone dealer and some other colorful titles. I was a little taken aback on that one. I'm like, drone dealer. Okay. You know, I do think that the militarized versions are what people have seen. And then there is some hyperbole out there where people think, oh, you know, this is the people are horsing around with military grade technology, which is not really the case. I mean, a lot of this technology came out of the remote control hobby shop. Right off the shelves there. And people were developing this technology to do commercial jobs, fine fish, farming. I was doing aerial photography for construction projects, mainly high-rise condos and things like that.
I mean, I just met this guy last winter in New Hampshire who was using a multi-rotor helicopter to carry a camera up an ice cliff for the ice climbers to see how the conditions are. Do you think reports on U.S. drone strikes like the one Amnesty International released today, how does that actually affect the drone industry and people like you?
I think it has a negative effect. You know, the general public, it's funny, you know, you ask people, you know, well, when I say drone, what do you think? And they usually, what I hear is, oh, it's that gray thing with the bulbous nose that looks like a beluga whale with the missiles hanging off of it.
Yeah.
That kind of image, it's hard to combat, you know, and you say, well, you know, here's mine over here. You know, I want to do good things with it. It's kind of hard for them to understand that. Some military technologies just don't overlay well in the civilian world.
I mean, you're saying the technology is inherently innocuous, right?
Yes, from my view. I mean, it is weaponized. I think that's here to stay, unfortunately. I've never been a proponent for weaponized unmanned technology.
Drones, as you know, have this association with these negative uses by the military, as well as these big privacy issues, you know, drones staring in our backyards and bathroom windows. Don't you think that a proper and open discussion about these two foibles of the system really need to be had before we universally endorse the whole technology?
Absolutely. I encourage a discussion and a discourse with everyone. And I've even suggested, well, you know, maybe you write up some SOPs, you know, some standard operating procedures. You can use it to do this and that, and you can't use it to do this and that. And it's a privilege. And I would also say, you know, that I'm in favor of the Constitution, and we have a Fourth Amendment. And if it constitutes a search, you need a search warrant. It's that easy.
Patrick Egan, a drone advocate and an editor at the blog Small Unmanned Aerial Systems News. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
More about drones and the fight against elephant poaching later on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates premieres October 28th at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Being an international relief worker can sound like an adventure. Listen to this recruitment ad produced by one relief group a few years back.
No roads, no maps, saving lives in uncharted territory. Confronting every challenge along the way.
But former aid worker Jessica Alexander says the reality on the ground can be much trickier. Alexander's own relief work took her to Darfur, post-tsunami Sri Lanka, and Sierra Leone. And she describes some of the obstacles she encountered in her new memoir, Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid. Alexander doesn't set out to name and shame, so she doesn't list the aid groups she worked for, but she does describe some pretty dicey moments, like the mayhem that erupted when a crush of tens of thousands of frightened Darfur residents converged on a camp where she, then a 27-year-old novice, was in charge.
I was in over my head. I mean, it was extremely overwhelming. There were attacks that had just happened. But, you know, in the field of aid, a lot of times there's high staff turnover. And my predecessor had left and there was no one there to fill the role. And so I sort of jumped in and that became my position.
It takes a special kind of person to shoulder those pressures. You write at one point in Darfur, I wondered what they thought of me, a naive 27-year-old American girl clutching her camp management toolkit like a life vest.
What I would say about that situation is I was this American girl who could use a computer and type and speak in English, which is what people at headquarters did, what, you know, the donors did. And so, you know, I was the boss when all of my staff were much older than I was. They had way more experience in these places than I did. And so it was quite interesting to be, you know, this young person who was speaking to these elders with, you know, as though I was the authority when actually I would rely on them for just about everything.
Is there one situation that kind of invites more of those agencies that might need shaming? I mean, where did you see the weakest spine?
Well, one place that I worked at towards the end of the book, which you didn't mention, was Haiti. There were thousands of NGOs that came down to Haiti. Everything from vegan relief to, you know, more established UN organizations and NGOs. It created a huge mess because there were so many actors there doing their own little side projects. So you may go to a camp and you see a bunch of people who are there for a week with frisbees and taking photos of people in a camp when you're trying to do, you know, a nutritional program for children. So for example, a medical group that's very well intentioned may come and give vaccines to some children in a community. But if they haven't worked through the World Health Organization, through the Ministry of Health that is coordinating the health response, some NGOs who are may show up the next week and say, okay, we're ready to vaccinate children here. And the community leaders will say, oh, our children were already vaccinated. And you say, okay, well, for what and when and which ones? And, you know, they don't have the records because this organization didn't happen to work through the system. And so there were a lot of organizations there that I think were called out for bad practice. And now the aid community is being much more stringent about creating standards and certifying organizations so that this doesn't happen again.
You were assigned to some pretty intense postings, Jessica, and yet one of the worst parts of your experience was trying to reintegrate into your life in the U.S. after being out in the field. How is the adjustment going for you?
Part of my sort of mental unraveling had to do with, you know, leaving and the jolt of going to a completely different culture and context and disaster response and working there. And again, you know, moving around that country and working in some extreme environments. And then all of a sudden the next day, getting on a plane, going home and being expected to put on you know, a nice dress and do my hair and put on high heels and go mingle at an upscale party and rattle off stories about where I had been. And, you know, my friends just really wanted to relate to me. They wanted to know what I was up to, but I just couldn't articulate where I had just been. When people say, oh my gosh, how was it? There are so many things running through your head and you just say, it was fine, I guess. You know, it's really difficult to try to distill some of these experiences into party-appropriate stories.
Jessica Alexander's new memoir is called Chasing Chaos. Jessica, great to meet you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Cuba's communist authorities are focused on trying to improve the island's ailing economy. That's why they've introduced economic reforms like allowing Cubans to set up their own businesses. But it's still really hard to make a buck. Part of the blame has to be directed at Cuba's confusing two-currency system. There is the national peso, worth about 5 U.S. cents, and then there's the convertible peso, which equals about a dollar. This vast difference in value has created a split in Cuban society. Well, now the Cuban government has announced that it's doing away with this two-currency system. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford is in Havana. Tell us, first of all, Sarah, why Cuba created this two-currency system in the first place?
Well, the CUC, the convertible peso, was introduced in the 1990s, essentially to replace the dollar here, which was beginning to circulate very much on the black market. And it was something that the government here wanted to clamp down on. But it needed, obviously, a hard currency for all its foreign transactions and also for the tourist sector here. So essentially what you've got now is a system where the whole tourist sector and pretty much any quality good or service that you want to buy here in Cuba is available only in the convertible CUC, whereas the vast majority still of Cubans are paid their salaries in the Cuban peso, the CUP.
And so how does that all translate in terms of social division? How do you actually see it?
In my street, for example, the bars and the cafes here, they all sell in hard currency in the CUC. The shop at the end of the street, all the pasta, the biscuits, the milk, everything there that normal Cubans want to buy is available in hard currency because it's all imported, whereas the local produce, which is fairly poor quality and also pretty scarce, is in Cuban pesos, which is what Cuban people are generally paid in. And the idea is to try to clarify things, to make things more even, and to end, I think, the resentment which an increasing number of Cubans are feeling about this two-currency system.
I mean, aside from the confusion of a two-currency system, has the government explained why it's planning to scrap this two-currency system?
Yeah, because it has led to these glaring inequalities in a society which is meant to be egalitarian. And it's quite clear the two communities that have emerged, the hard currency community and the Cuban peso community, and that's not something that the government here wants to continue. It does want to eventually move towards a sustainable economy here where it can pay people in a currency that enables them to afford the items that they need to live with. So it is a real problem, a social problem, and it's been the cause of an awful lot of resentment here that people are paid in one money and have to live in another. And I think the government is perfectly aware of that. And I think this is a major step towards redressing the balance. But as I say, it's not clear how that's going to happen and what the impact will be in the short term. And people are worried about a possible devaluation and how that will affect them.
Capitalism pulling it in one direction, ideology pulling it in the other. It's kind of the story of Cuba for the last 20 years or so.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I mean, the changes that are taking place here are fairly broad ranging. And the interesting thing about it is that Cuba never talks about reform. It doesn't even use the word reform. It talks about updating the model. Stresses that this is a socialist economy, but it's just being updated. It's not being reformed or changed.
The BBC, Sarah Rainsford in Havana. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on the world, sriracha. It's the hottest thing in hot sauces. Haven't heard of it? Just look for the distinctive bottle.
The bottle looks kind of like the chili peppers that they use. They use red jalapenos that have, you know, green stems, kind of like the green cap. The body of the pepper is red, kind of like the sriracha bottle is red.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. and by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates premieres October 28th at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. President Obama is pushing for immigration reform again, but there's little reason to think that a deeply divided Congress will oblige. And even if there is reform, some of the harsh realities facing undocumented immigrants are unlikely to change. The World's Jason Margolis has one example.
Nathaniel Hoffman never set out to write a love story. But his new book, Amor in Exile, is just that. It chronicles married couples who share a theme. One spouse is American, the other is an undocumented immigrant. One couple in the book is Juan and Veronica. Hoffman met Veronica, a nurse's aide, at a rally in Idaho.
And she stood up with a sonogram picture of that she'd gotten that day and said that, you know, her fiancé was behind bars and she didn't know she'd ever see him again. And the next day after that, they got married, actually. She was able to visit, and they had a pastor come and do a ceremony through the bars of the Ada County jail.
Then Veronica's husband was deported to Mexico. She stayed in Idaho with her two daughters. Couples like Veronica and Juan have the right to get married, and a U.S. citizen spouse has the right to sponsor their undocumented partner to live in the U.S.
But in order for that to be carried through, they have to leave the country, which triggers some kind of ban from coming back.
It can happen like this. If an undocumented immigrant marrying a U.S. citizen wants to legalize their status here, they typically have to go back to their home country to start the process. It means they must come clean to U.S. officials that they entered America illegally. And that can trigger the bad news. A 1996 law can ban immigrants who have crossed over illegally from re-entering the U.S. for 5, 10, 20 years, even permanently. This can separate couples, but some find an alternative to living apart, leave the U.S. entirely.
We had a going-away party at a friend's house. It was very sad.
That's Nicole Salgado. She's a U.S. citizen who left California for Mexico 7 years ago. She spoke to me from her home in Querétaro, a state in central Mexico. Salgado is an Ivy League grad from a working-class suburb of Syracuse, New York. Her husband, Margo Resendiz, is Mexican. He went to California without papers to work in construction, but the couple found it tough to build a life together in California.
We were just really concerned that, you know, Margo could get pulled over and filed at any time. It wasn't looking very realistic for us to be able to buy a home either because he would have to co-sign and he didn't have papers.
The couple is now in year 7 of a 10-year exile. Nicole and their daughter can travel to the U.S. freely, just not Margo. He's serving his punishment for crossing the border illegally when he was a young man, hidden in the trunk of a car. Officers told Margo he'd face a 10-year ban if he tried again. He did anyway. Salgado co-wrote the book Amor in Exile from Querétaro. The chapters flip between Nathaniel Hoffman's reporting from Idaho and Salgado's first-person story of her self-imposed exile.
I think I was sort of socially isolated for, like, a while, maybe the first, like, year, couple years.
Salgado says the adjustment has gotten easier. I asked her if they'd apply to return to the U.S. in 3 years when the 10-year ban against Margo expires.
Well, it's a really hard choice, and I get asked it all the time. The thing that I just think of constantly is, like, I just would love the choice. You know, I mean, obviously we have our home here now that we've built, and we have friends, we have a social circle. But the economic situation is very tenable because just not making it on the Mexico income.
Salgado also realizes that her husband broke the law when he crossed the border twice illegally, but she doesn't think the current law is a just one.
I have to say I think it's draconian. I mean, I understand the need for a rule of law, an orderly immigration system, but I also do feel like it's quite a bit of time to serve for a civil infraction. Seems like punishment should fit the crime.
The plight of married couples like Salgado has flown under the radar during the immigration debate. Recently, Salgado and her co-author Nathaniel Hoffman went to Washington. They rolled a dolly stacked with their new book through the halls of the U.S. Capitol, handing out copies to lawmakers. Salgado hopes Congress will consider the case of exiled Americans like her. If not, she's got a date circled on her calendar, September of 2016. That's when she can return home, this time with her husband. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
So I've got a bottle in my fridge. We've got one here at work. You may have one. The clear plastic bottle, red sauce, a green needle nose cap, and a rooster on the front. A staple at any Vietnamese restaurant and popular all over the world. Sriracha, it's called. I've long noticed from the label that this stuff comes from Rosemead, California, just outside of L.A., so I've always wanted to hear the backstory. Lucky for us, Roberto Ferdman has written about sriracha for the online news site Quartz.
Sriracha is not the name of the brand. Hoi Fung is the name of the company, and they make a version of sriracha, which is kind of the equivalent of saying, like, barbecue sauce in Vietnam. It's basically a type of sauce that's used to put in pho. However, David Tran, who's the founder of Hoi Fung, made his own version that's come to be known as sriracha. So in the U.S., sriracha means pretty much one thing, and it's Hoi Fung sriracha.
Right. And if you go to Vietnam, generally speaking, you would find some kind of hot sauce to put in your pho. That was the market that Tran was trying to approach, right?
That's very true, yes. So Tran is originally from Vietnam, although his family is from China originally. He took a boat to Boston in 1979. And eventually made his way down to Los Angeles, where he founded Hoi Fung in 1980. When he started making sriracha, it was basically an attempt to bring this sauce that he liked so much from home to the U.S., and not just to himself, but also to the Vietnamese community in Los Angeles.
There's a rooster on the bottle, and Hoi Fung itself, the name of the company, they're both significant to David Tran, right?
Hoi Fung is the name of the freighter that David Tran took from Vietnam to Boston in 1979. And then the rooster is his astrological sign. So there's a significance to both of those. And then you'll notice that the bottle looks kind of like the chili peppers that they use. They use red jalapenos that have, green stems, kind of like the green cap. The body of the pepper is red, kind of like the sriracha bottle is red.
And the red jalapeno that David Tran uses for this hot sauce, this very recognizable hot sauce, that seems to be what sets this sauce apart from everything else, that these are fresh red jalapenos.
Fresh is actually the right word. People don't generally know a whole lot about how hot sauces are made. I think that's a fair assumption. But most are made with dried chilies, and it just makes production a lot easier. Hoi Fung, rather, makes their sriracha using fresh chilies. It means that they have to bottle the peppers or process them within a day of harvesting or picking them. So their factory needs to be very near where they harvest their peppers. And it's actually played a significant role in the growth and really the cap on the company's growth.
Well, it hasn't impeded the growth by any means, doing this, because I gather that last year David Tran sold 20 million bottles of sriracha, and he's never advertised his product. Why not? You spoke with him. Why doesn't he advertise?
Those two are actually pretty closely tied together, the fact they use fresh chilies and the fact that they've never advertised. David told me that they've grown in the double digits since 1980 annually. Griffin Hammond, who's a documentarian making a documentary about sriracha at the moment, told me that David said to him that the number is something like 20% per year. That number, however, could presumably be higher because since they rely on using fresh chilies, they can't make bottles of sriracha unless they have enough chilies, and they haven't been able to produce enough chilies to meet demand. There's always been more demand for it than supply. That's why they can't advertise. If you were to advertise, he would basically tempt more people into wanting to buy sriracha and upset a bunch of people who wouldn't be able to get the product because there simply isn't enough of it.
Is this an accident? Is he an unwitting, kind of very smart businessman, or is he just kind of like drifting through this whole thing, I just want to make hot sauce kind of attitude?
It's something of both. Definitely, it seems from having spoken to David that the main driver of his enthusiasm about the company and his continued involvement in it is just his love for the sauce and his love for making it. He's been approached many times to sell the company, has not budged. There's something really endearing about it, and I think that it's helped brew this kind of cult culture behind it.
Are you a fan of Sriracha Roberto, or are you just writing about it?
I use sriracha pretty much every day with breakfast. I love sriracha with eggs.
Roberto Ferdman, journalist and sriracha connoisseur. He recently profiled the creator of Hoi Fung sriracha hot sauce for the online news site Quartz. Roberto, great to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Great speaking with you, too. Thank you for having me.
So I like a dollop of sriracha on a peanut butter, banana, and honey sandwich fried in butter. No, that's not weird. And yes, it's really good. So how do you use your sriracha? Tell us at PRI.org or tweet us at PRI The World. They'll need plenty of sriracha in southwest Colombia. That's because the heat of passion has vanished from one town there. The women have stopped having sex with their husbands. They'll begin again, they say, when repairs are made to the roads that connect the town to the outside world. The women's urgency is clear, and the tactic they took may be working. Reporter John Otis in Bogota has been following the story. Tell us more, John, about why these women have started this so-called crossed leg movement.
Well, Marco, we're talking about a little town in southwest Colombia called Barbacoas. It's very isolated. It's Colombians like to say you go to the end of the earth and take a left. That's kind of where this place is located. They've only got one dirt road leading to the rest of civilization, and it's in terrible shape. It can take up to 14 hours to get to the next town over in the nearest hospital. And the problem is something like a dozen medical patients have died along that road trying to get to the hospital. There have even been pregnant women who've died in the back of ambulances on that road trying to get some medical care. So in desperation, the women called a sex strike in 2011. It lasted for 38 days. The politicians finally stepped in and said, okay, we're going to rebuild that road. But then nothing happened for the next 2 years. So some of the women went back on strike. And now just this month, the Army Corps of Engineers has announced, yes, we are rebuilding that road and the bulldozers are in there and they're getting going on it. So there appears to be a happy ending this time.
Well, the road's not paved yet. Is there any possibility that the Army could kind of like fall asleep on the job again and not get it done?
Well, that's always a possibility here in Colombia. There's a lot of corruption. The money runs out, and you can have long stretches of pavement, and then suddenly you have gravel, and you have to slam on the brakes.
It's interesting, though. I mean, it's not a story about these people in this little town having a smooth, cushy ride on new tarmac. It's a kind of a matter of life and death, isn't it?
It certainly is, Marco, and that's sort of a wider problem in Colombia. Roads are bad here all over the country. There's three Andean mountain ranges, so building roads is tough. There's a guerrilla war going on, so it can be dangerous to go in and repair roads. Even the good roads are bad. Just to get a container, for example, if you're going to send a container of Colombian goods to China, it'll cost you more to bring it to a Colombian port than to get it from that Colombian port all the way across the other side of the world to China.
Wow, that's incredible. Not to get lost in stereotypes, John, but Colombia is a passionate country. Has this strike been a big water cooler topic like in Bogota?
It's been an interesting issue. I mean, one of the reasons you do call a sex strike is to get some media attention and to get the attention of the politicians and to sort of embarrass people into taking action. And so it's been done here in Colombia several times. In fact, back in the 90s, when the war was going really badly for the Colombian army, the head of the Colombian armed forces came out on national television and suggested that the wives and girlfriends of the guerrillas go on a sex strike to sort of force a peace treaty, force their men to negotiate with the government. And, Colombians were sort of amazed because it almost sounded like this was going to be the national strategy of the army to go forward with the war. I mean, there was a lot of joking about it.
Yeah, it's in the Colombian toolbox. I'm curious, John, what's the shape of your driveway at home in Bogota?
The road up to my house is in pretty bad shape, I have to admit. Sometimes you just have to drive a four-wheel drive around here.
Just curious. Reporter John Otis in Bogota, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Back now to the topic we opened the program with, drones. As we heard earlier, drones are a controversial weapon in the fight against terrorism, but they're also used for many other purposes. Here's a quick look at one of those other uses. A remote-controlled aircraft is now being enlisted in one of the world's epic efforts to protect wildlife.
We bought a drone, the cheapest one you can buy.
That's Mark Goss of the Mara Elephant Project in Kenya. The organization is part of the fight against a huge surge in elephant poaching across Africa. In Kenya alone, more than 16,000 pounds of ivory have been seized in the last few months. The Elephant Project hasn't been able to match the firepower of the poachers, but it has discovered that a cheap drone can at least help move elephants out of harm's way.
What we use it for, this technology, is really to scare elephants out of areas where people are growing crops. Now, in scenarios where you've got long grass and poachers can lie down on the long grass, a bird's eye view can be very useful.
That's one reason the group is considering buying more drones and mounting cameras on at least one of the $300 aircraft. Goss says the drones are part of a broader push to step up Kenya's anti-poaching efforts.
Kenya are starting to prosecute poachers and ivory dealers under the Economic Crimes Act and the Organized Crimes Act, rather than the Wildlife Act of having a trophy without a license.
But Mark Goss says the Mara Elephant Project has ruled out at least one idea, using drones to go after the poachers themselves.
I've seen some YouTube videos where they've got a shotgun on a drone, which seem pretty effective at shooting targets. But no, that's not in our docket.
Well, might be on someone's docket before long. The UN says the illegal ivory trade has more than doubled in the last 6 years. Coming up, think the Star Spangled Banner and America the Beautiful all in one. That's next here on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom, in theaters now.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The medley can be the musical equivalent of saying, I can't make up my mind. You want Let It Be or Get Back? Oh, I don't know. Can you just stitch them together? But what if we're talking national anthems, songs that ideally should serve to unify a country and encourage a sense of shared identity? If your country has a divided history, though, like South Africa, that's a tough proposition. But a medley of anthems might work. Well, in Cape Town, South Africa, the world's Anders Kelto, all this year, has been following a public high school. It's called the Center of Science and Technology, or COSAT. And today, Anders brings us this story of a medley and its history.
On Monday mornings, school assemblies at COSAT begin like this. Students sing the South African national anthem. The first half of the song sounds beautiful. It has rich harmonies and a peaceful, distinctly African sound. Then, right in the middle, there's an abrupt change. Suddenly, it sounds like a triumphant march, and very European. I found myself wondering, how did these two different tunes get mashed together? I asked Tandi. She's the 12th grader who leads the national anthem at school assemblies.
I don't know why they designed it that way.
I talked to a few other students, and they didn't know either. So I decided to go to someone who would know.
I'm Paul Titchman.
Paul Titchman is a curator at South Africa's National Museum in Cape Town. He said there's an interesting story behind South Africa's national anthem, and it starts 100 years ago. He played an old recording for me. It's a song called Die Stem van Suid-Afrika, The Call of South Africa. It's based on a 1918 Afrikaans poem. Titchman said the song became popular among South Africans of Dutch descent, Afrikaners, in the early 20th century. The lyrics talk about the Afrikaners' deep connection to the land and the beauty of the mountains and oceans.
Interestingly, it was actually written as a protest.
A protest against British rule in South Africa. A few decades later, in 1948, an Afrikaans political party gained control of South Africa. It imposed significant changes on the country, including apartheid, the system of racial segregation. And the anthem of this new segregated republic was Die Stem. Paul Titchman said black South Africans did not consider the song their anthem.
It was perceived as the anthem of the oppressor. For most black people, that was the feeling.
As apartheid marched forward, a black resistance movement was growing. And it also centered around a song, one that dated from years before. The song is called Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, God Bless Africa. This recording is from 1929, sung by a high school choir near Johannesburg. It's an old African hymn that was well known throughout the continent. Paul Titchman of the South African Museum said it began as a purely religious song, a plea to God for help and peace. But soon, it took on political meaning.
it was taken up by all the organizations involved in the struggle against apartheid.
It was sung at churches, rallies, and protests in South Africa and across the continent. Black political groups, like the African National Congress, embraced the song.
In government, we will not be satisfied with anything less than the direct individual adult suffrage.
Albert Luthuli, president of the African National Congress, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1961. He famously ended his acceptance speech in Oslo with a passionate rendition of the song. Some members of the audience joined in. By this time, Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika was the song of the African struggle. When apartheid ended in 1994, many argued that the song should become South Africa's new national anthem. But Nelson Mandela and other leaders felt otherwise. They decided it should not replace Die Stem, the apartheid anthem, but be combined with it. The South African Museum's Paul Tichman says the decision was controversial, but had powerful symbolism.
It was a way of sending a message saying that we are all one, you know, that we are all part of South Africa and that there's room for all of us.
But some of the lyrics in Die Stem were problematic. They talked about Afrikaners fighting and dying for the land, land they had seized from Zulus and other black South Africans. Tichman said it was clear those lyrics could not be included.
It would just be a reminder of aspects of our history that are quite painful.
So the offensive references were dropped. And then there was the question of what language the anthem should be sung in. South Africa has 11 official languages. Mandela and others decided to include 5 of them, the 3 most common native languages, Xhosa, Zulu, and Sotho, plus English and Afrikaans. Tichman said initially, attitudes toward this merged, multilingual anthem were lukewarm. At many sporting events and public gatherings,
the first part from Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika would be sung with great vigor, and then it would quieten as you got to Die Stem.
But what about now? What does the current generation, born in a free South Africa, think of the national anthem? Back at COSAT, the high school near Cape Town, I found some students who knew the history of the song. An eighth grader named Paulo said he loves the anthem, especially the fact that it includes 5 languages.
I think it really combines a nation, combines its languages into one, and it makes it feel whole.
Pumela, a senior, said she likes what the song stands for, and she much prefers it to the old apartheid-era version.
The old one was more for one side, whites only. This one is for everyone.
I couldn't help but think, maybe this new anthem really is helping to create what Nelson Mandela had hoped for, a more united South Africa. For the world, I'm Anders Kelto in Cape Town.
You'll find more from Anders and that South African high school at pri.org/schoolyear. Okay, so South Africa's anthem is a mashup of 2 songs. Well, we had a little fun today. What if we added a 3rd track? You might recognize this. That's the percussion from our theme song. Now add it to the South African anthem and you get the dance version. Pretty cool, right? So here's our challenge to you. Can you produce your own national anthem mashup? How about the Star Spangled Banner mixed with We Can't Stop? Or maybe La Marseillaise and Thriller? We want to hear your creation. Send us your mix and we'll feature it on our website, maybe even on air. Just go to pri.org and look for our National Anthem Contest. You've got 1 week from today to submit those entries. We'll be looking for them. That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.